This week on Making Contact.
By about 1970, the United States had sort of played itself out.
We lost 50% of our industrial workforce.
This is not a problem that's going to be solved by throwing money at banks.
It's a time of economic transition, and systems that may have seemed stable over the past few decades are proving to be far from it. But how did we get here? And how can we learn from the past to build a more fair and just system in the future? While many politicians and pundits claim that no one saw the current economic collapse coming, in fact, we had plenty of warning, depending on who we listened to. This week, we hear from three people who've been sounding the alarm about capitalism's house of cards for years, and in some cases, decades. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
In talking about the economic crisis, for me, one of the best places to start is in Cuba with Fidel. Fidel wound up writing this reflection at the end of October called Economic Illiteracy. He ends it by saying, when a people leaves behind illiteracy and learns to read and write and possess the minimum knowledge that is indispensable for living and producing in an honorable way, they still need to overcome the worst form of ignorance in our time. Economic illiteracy. Only in that way can we understand what is occurring in the world. And I just think that he hits on this point exactly right, that there are particular levels of understanding and consciousness that a lot of activists, a lot of leftists have, but don't have a deep, sophisticated understanding of the economy. And I think it inhibits us from both being able to understand what's going on around us and actually shift the course of history.
That's Steve Williams. He's the executive director and co-founder of POWER, People Organized to Win Employment Rights. He's just one of many trying to explain what's been going on in the U.S. and all over the world lately. For the first time in generations, economic theories like socialism and Marxism are being considered by the mainstream media and the public at large. So today, we're going to let three vocal critics of the failed system tell the story of why we're in the state we're in and share their ideas for moving forward. You just heard Steve Williams. We'll also hear from Rick Wolf.
We have a generation of leaders who haven't the faintest idea what to do.
He's an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
I made more money than teachers as a steelworker.
And that's Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology and urban education at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Together, they'll tell one version of the history of modern capitalism.
We now see a capitalist economic system not only facing its greatest crisis in my lifetime, and that means in most of yours, but a fast diminution of its self-confidence. We recognize not only that the system is in trouble, but we have a generation of leaders who haven't the faintest idea what to do about it. And that, too, is a fundamental shift. So I'd like to address myself, if I can, briefly, to explain how and why capitalism hit the fan. The first thing. Every president since the greatest crash so far in the 1930s, starting with Franklin Roosevelt, has made us a promise which they could not keep. The promise was not only to take steps that would bring us out of the particular downturn, but most importantly, to take steps that would prevent us from ever again having to face an economic system as unstable as capitalism has always proved itself to be. Every president promised it, and no president was able to keep the promise. We certainly have not had an end to instability.
When people talk about, popularly talk about, what is the cause of the economic crisis, the thing that people will constantly refer to is greed, right? And so, well, what's interesting is that when you talk about greed, well, then the resolution to that, like the remedy is, you need to stop people from being greedy. Either you transform their humanity and sort of make them selfless, you know, humanitarians, or you establish regulations to sort of limit their capacity to be able to act off of greed, right? So there's this guy, Paul Krugman, who is 2008 Nobel Prize winner. And his statement in the New York Times was, the meltdown was caused by greed followed by fear. It was caused by a housing bubble and the greed of people who rushed in to make money off of it. But the thing that I want to sort of underscore, at least to me, what's been interesting in sort of looking at the coverage around this, is that's as deep as the analysis goes. Like, people will say, if they don't say that it's greed and fear that caused the financial crisis, it was the credit default swaps, and that's it. And so I think if we're not able to sort of look deeper at a systemic level, again, that we're just going to be sort of lost in the obscurity of the very minutiae of what it is that folks are talking about.
We are now in the second major collapse of capitalism in 75 years. And if you count, there were about a dozen smaller or not so small downturns in the interval. If you lived with a person as unstable as the economic system in which you exist, you'd demand they get professional help. But we as a nation seem very wary to do the same with our economic system, although I think we should.
I would say that for leftists, there are really two questions that we've got to figure out. One is, how did this crisis come into being? And then secondly, what are we going to try to do about it? I think we've got to figure this out, because the historical conjuncture that we're in is going to sort of shape the terrain that we're fighting on for the next several generations.
How is it that we got to this situation? We are not in a conventional economic downturn. I'm going to argue briefly that this is a downturn that has been building ever since at least the Civil War in the United States. At the end of the Civil War, capitalism became triumphant. It had defeated slavery, and it had subordinated self-employed businesses and small businesses to the corporate capitalism that really took off. For the next 100 years, roughly 1870 to 1970, American capitalism performed extraordinarily. Productivity went up in an almost uninterrupted process. That is, year after year, the bundles of goods and services and an hour of labor produced grew. And across the same 100 years, so did real wages. The actual bundle of goods and services workers got also rose. For 100 years, a steady rise. Extraordinary. A record not equaled by most, if any, other capitalist economies.
From about after World War II through the early 1970s, capitalism was just booming on a global scale. Capitalism wound up sort of just expanding dramatically. The rate of growth was phenomenal. And the United States wound up being sort of at the lead of it, mostly because of World War II, and colonialism had sort of inhibited anybody else from being able to develop the productive capacity that would have otherwise been possible because of the level of technological advance. So the United States was just sort of like the only show in town and was just sort of running the game.
In that period of time, because the wages kept rising, Americans began to think of their society as very exceptional. Something was special here. Wages went up, standards of living went up. It was a blessed land. And Americans came to expect their standard of living to rise, to believe they were entitled to it, to measure their own success and importance as individuals in terms of their rising standard of living. Why did the wages go up? Because the capital accumulation in our society kept running ahead of workers. For the first 50 years of that 100, we solved that problem by bringing an unprecedented number of immigrants into the country. That wasn't enough to prevent wages from rising, and they rose through that time and in the next 50 years too, until the 1970s. Stunning record.
But by about 1970, the United States had sort of played itself out. And so there were particular challenges that the United States was facing around 1970.
In the 1970s, it all came to a stop. Real wages of American workers stopped rising after a 100-year increase. The American society could not cope with this, and one of the ways it could not cope, or the form that took, was by not realizing it was going on, not making it a national conversation. What in the world is going to happen to a people who've internalized rising standards of living when their economic system doesn't provide it? Employers, starting in the 1970s, didn't have to raise wages anymore. They didn't for several quick reasons. One, A new technology, the computer, allowed people to be replaced by machines on a scale we hadn't seen before. At the same time, corporations moved jobs out of the United States to where wages and conditions were more profitable. Women began entering the labor force in record numbers, and immigrants started coming again in big numbers. You put all those things together, no more need to raise wages in the 1970s, and we have not raised real wages in any kind of sustained way ever since. To stop raising wages after 100 years in a society that has become accustomed to it is a trauma, and it's reacted to in traumatic fashion. And the way that was done produces the crisis we have now, hence my argument that it's a deeply embedded crisis with profound roots. What happened in the last 30 years after the wages stopped going up? I'm going to answer the question by quickly looking at what the workers did and then quickly looking at what the capitalists did. What the workers did was to react to the end of rising wages, not by giving up the American dream of rising consumption, not by foregoing the measurement of one's own success in life by what one can afford. Instead, Americans did two major things. The first one was, if I can't get more wages per hour of work, I'm going to do more work. And so the husbands did more work. The old people came out of retirement, part-timers did full-time, teenagers went to work. But the most important thing, the women. Huge numbers of American women had to go out to work in order to keep the consumption going. And the American working class suffered in two key ways. First, it became exhausted. Today, the average number of hours worked by an American worker is 20% more than the average number of hours worked by a French, German, Italian, or Swedish worker. That's not a small difference. American workers are exhausted. And when the mothers went out to work, they couldn't sustain the pressures of the double shift that follows from this situation. And the American family began that kind of accelerated disintegration that provided one of the great opportunities for the Republican Party to return to power. And the second thing the American working class did, beside work itself to death, physically and emotionally, was to borrow more money than any working class had ever before borrowed anywhere, period. So that 30 years later, the American working class is physically exhausted, emotionally stressed, and bent out of shape with anxiety about a level of debt it knows it cannot sustain.
There are about 50 million families in the United States that carry a credit card balance of $5,000 or more. The amount of consumer credit that people wind up falling into just winds up increasing dramatically. The other thing is that then the economy of the United States really shifts much more to consumption. So 70% of the GDP of the gross domestic product of the United States is consumption of stuff. And they're buying it on credit cards.
What happened to business over the last 30 years? The biggest bonanza they had ever had. The profits went crazy for a simple reason. If each worker produces more each hour, that's what rising productivity means, but you don't have to pay him anymore, or you don't have to pay her anymore, well, then the whole benefit of rising productivity accrues to profits, which it did. And the American folks, corporate boards of directors and shareholders, who are the ones who get the profits, began to have one of the greatest picnics ever seen. So what did they do? You know what they did. They began to pay themselves stupefying salaries and bonuses. We're all angry now, but it's 30 years late. They've been doing it a long time, and no one seemed to notice or care. They went on a mergers and acquisitions binge. They invested this profit abroad.
And during this period, it was not the case alone that the problems were because of outsourcing to other countries. Yes, that was a major problem. The second problem was the rapid pace of technological change. That took place at a very rapid rate at the same time as there was tremendous financialization, you know what that is, and at the same time as there was tremendous outsourcing. But the result is that we lost 50% of our industrial workforce. And as somebody who spent his first 10 years as a worker in the steel mill, we had better jobs than most people in the service economy.
They developed into speculative manias, one after the other. The most fantastic was to go back to the working class, the fountain of all of this wealth, and say to the workers, look, now that we haven't raised your wages, after 100 years of making you expect to consume more, we have a solution. The extra profits we make by not paying you wages, we're going to turn them around and lend them to you at interest, which they did, allowing the capitalist class to substitute for rising wages, rising loans. Now imagine yourself a businessman or woman. What would be a fantasy you might enjoy? Substituting for the rising wages your workers might otherwise demand, an alternative. Lend them the money. That way they have to pay you that back and interest. At this point, if I had a time, I'd play you the national anthem.
The other thing that wound up happening is that as particularly sort of Europe and the third world nations had developed their productive capacity, there was just more and more stuff on the global market. So then as a consequence, the capitalists who were constantly looking for new opportunities to be able to accumulate more profits, there were fewer and fewer places for people to be able to put their money and confidently be able to get profit back. Around that time is when you see the rise of neoliberalism. So you have a shift in how it is that the ruling class is managing capitalism. You move from sort of the Keynesian approach where the government is freely sort of subsidizing social contracts, safety net programs, and then you ultimately wind up moving to a situation where governments all across the globe wind up instituting neoliberal programs, cutting back on safety net programs, privatizing industries, deregulating industries, so that then essentially trying to create as free of a terrain, as free of an area for capital to be able to operate and accumulate profit as possible. So all this is playing out around the 1970s. This is also the time when you see more and more money going into speculative capital. So up until this point in time, the amount of money that was going into stocks and bonds was about one third to one half of the world GDP. Within about 6 years after 1970, you see the proportion shift so that now more money is going into speculation, into the stocks and bonds market, as opposed to in direct investment into production. So hopefully that then sort of sets a stage for from 1970 through about 2000.
And the problem that we are facing right now is that much of what passed for prosperity, all of the boom and bust of the last 25 years, beginning in the early 80s, when the deindustrialization began to take legs, is because much of the capital which has been generated is what Karl Marx calls fictitious capital. It's phony capital. And it disappeared just as fast it was, much faster than it was produced.
This is an extraordinary history. But it produces a level of speculation and a level of overextension of the financial sector that's the perfect parallel to the other kind of overextension of the working class that financed it, that made it possible, and that is even more exhausted than the capitalists now are. These are not short-term problems, no quick fix here. This is not going to be solved by conventional Keynesian monetary and fiscal policy or by getting the credit systems going again. Who's going to borrow? The exhausted workers who can't sustain their current debts? The companies who can't keep producing since the workers can't buy it anyway? This is a fundamental problem, which is why this is not your usual economic downturn.
In my opinion, the ruling class is trying to run the most elaborate sleight of hand that we've ever seen.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We'll be right back. We now return to our program featuring Steve Williams, Rick Wolf, and Stanley Aronowitz.
So then, what is to be done? I don't think the conventional approaches will work. I propose an alternative. I think our problem is that we have not yet been willing as a nation to face the reality that the corporate structure, which dominates and has dominated since the Civil War, is a structure that does not work. The mass of people go to work each day. At the end of the day, they go home, they leave behind what they poured their creativity into. Who decides what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits is a completely other group of people, a tiny minority, a board of directors, which in most corporations runs 15 to 20 people, who are responsible to the company's major shareholders, which is another group of 50 to 20. The tiniest of minorities governs the economic system, and they make bad decisions over and over again. And all we seem to come up with as a nation are a lot of policies that we hope maybe, if we're lucky and if they're nice, will make them behave better. And we're outraged that they don't. And our capacity for repeated outrage is stunning. Let's change the organization of that institution which produces the goods and services we all depend on. We don't need it anymore, and we can't tolerate it anymore, and we ought to have the courage to get rid of it. Just like once upon a time we decided politically that our leaders have to be responsible to us, the same really ought to apply to economics, don't you think? The businesses of America ought to be operated and run by the workers who work in them. That change goes to the heart of the current crisis. If workers had run the businesses in the 1970s, the rising real wage would not have come to a stop. If I had time, and I don't want to take more time, I could talk to you about all the different ways workers can operate their own businesses. I would talk to you about how that's democracy at the workplace. I would tell you that if workers were able to run their own businesses, the difference between mental and manual labor would be overcome, a dream of all socialists for hundreds of years, that workers would be asked to run their own affairs. And you know, if they ran them in the workplace, they damn well demand to run them everywhere else too. The formality of our democracy might become real politically if it were real economically. Is it a bold proposal? You bet. The old approaches have not worked. It's time for something new, and this crisis calls for nothing less than the kind of leadership that socialists who can dare think like this can provide by pursuing these ideas and seeing to it that the rage that is building in our society doesn't become an opportunity for the next George Bush to ride in.
There are a couple things that we've got to be paying attention to. One is the rise of the right. The degree to which the neoliberal right is discredited is real. But the other thing is that the reactionary right is also on the rise. So the Southern Poverty Law Center just put out a report saying that there are, I think it was 38% more hate groups in the United States now than there were last year that they're tracking. Use the example of one particular website. And said that the day after Obama got elected, the membership on this white supremacist website went up 2,000 members overnight. The degree to which you can already see the sort of nativist, like blame everybody outside the United States, particularly immigrants, that's going to continue to rise. I think that it's important for us to be mindful of that and figure out how it is that we can play sort of a defensive role for this regime and what it is that they're trying to do. But I think that it's also important for us to be clear that we're not the liberals, that we are the left, and the left should be acting like the left.
When we think about what it was that really created the jobs that were produced by the New Deal in the Works Projects Administration and the various programs, it was not Franklin Roosevelt being a wonderful guy. We had a movement called End Poverty in California, at the same time as you had two general strikes, one in San Francisco, the other in Minneapolis, a big movement in Toledo, garment workers and miners on strike, and Roosevelt said, Jesus, God, I better get my shit together, because if I don't get my shit together, I'm going to sink. And it was true, he could have sunk. And what he knew that we've forgotten, I have to say this, is that in that period when we had the beginning of jobs programs and the government actually directly employed people, did not give it to subcontractors, did not give it to banks or anybody else, is that we had a communist party, we had a socialist party, we had Trotskyists, we had anarchists, and they were all fighting and organizing.
With that, I think that there are things that we should be doing. The first is to promote socialism. And I think the scale of this crisis and the popular outrage that exists around it just creates historic opportunities and openings that could actually spark the renewal of a radical movement in this country. But it's going to take us being clear and talking about the fundamental flaws of capitalism and that we can actually build an alternative. And obviously, around the globe, there are a lot of people doing that. So I point specifically to Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian movement in Venezuela, where they're talking explicitly about socialism of the 21st century and are trying to sort of invent sort of a new project.
But socialism for the 21st century has to have new dramatic visions that will galvanize people with the thought of something new and different that can make a real difference.
I think once we have this sort of clear long-term vision, it then gives us the possibility of figuring out, well, how is it that we're trying to make policy interventions on what's going on in a day-to-day basis? So I think it's important for us to be clear that being a leftist isn't just sort of reading theory books and passing out newspapers at rallies that we didn't organize. But instead, what it means is having this vision and beginning to make sort of policy suggestions that could actually sort of begin the long road from capitalism to socialism.
This is not a problem that's going to be solved by throwing money at banks. This is a problem of a fundamental overextension of a working class that has to be addressed in the most fundamental way by how we organize our life, organize our family unit, and organize the work process.
Just sort of like trying to prep for this, I wound up coming across this quotation from Marx that I just thought was interesting and wanted to end with. The centralization of the means of production and the socialization of labor reach a point at which they become incompatible with their capitalist enclosure. This casting is burst asunder, the knell of capitalist private property sounds, and the expropriators are expropriated. So I think that there's some real opportunities for us, and we should get to it.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Today's program featured the voices of Steve Williams, the executive director and co-founder of POWER, People Organized to Win Employment Rights, Professor Rick Wolf, whose most recent books include New Departures in Marxian Theory and Class Theory and History, and Professor Stanley Aronowitz, author of Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Aronowitz's speech was from a March 2009 forum presented by WBAI Radio and the New York Society for Ethical Culture, and is courtesy of Building Bridges. Steve Williams spoke in February 2009 at the Bay Area Progressive Club, and Rick Wolf spoke at the Left Forum in April 2009. Special thanks to our intern, Megan Martigny, for helping to produce this show. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.